Ladies and gentlemen, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
Ladies and gentlemen, to this episode of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We're coming to you from beautiful Northwest Pennsylvania live, as we are each and every weekday, Monday through Friday, 7 to 10 p.m., right here on Global Star Radio Network. We are also live on a video, which you can find on YouTube, as well as on, we are simulcast on Blog Talk Radio. Don't forget, we have two websites. We have HagmanReport.com, and we have HagmanandHagman.com. And also, don't forget, The latest, my dad has been updating and reviving the old site, the Northeast Intelligence Network, HomelandSecurityUS.com. And both on HomelandSecurityUS.com, as well as on HagmanReport.com, at the very top of both of those sites, we have a great segment that was put together yesterday. It's from an interview we did with Randall Terry. And it's perfect. The timing of this couldn't be more perfect. Refusing to understand the greatest threat we face. Randall Terry Hagman Report Special. Now, this is, again, very timely, very important, as we had over the weekend the latest in the Islamic terror threat, the Ramadan attacks, the London, what they're calling the London Bridge attacks, took place on Saturday evening, London time, about 10 p.m. London time. And, you know, just on a few weeks after Manchester, here we are again. Actually, I believe Manchester was 2 weeks ago today or tomorrow. And we saw this weekend some more terrorism. We saw three attackers who finally, after a while of other investigations and arrests in the U.K., that these attackers have been named. Two of the attackers were named. The third one is still yet to be released. And this was, you know, a crazy terror attack. They used a multi-prong approach. You had these men in a van, in a rented van, and what they did was, on the London Bridge, they began to attack with the vehicle, mowing down almost 20 people in the bridge attack, and then leaving the vehicles armed with fake suicide vests and with knives. They began to stab people eating dinner at restaurants and drinking at pubs. And right away, many people were calling it terrorism. There was actually a feud, if you will, where Drudge Report tweeted something out, you know, another terror attack unfolding, and the president retweeted the info that Drudge put out. Drudge tweeted, "Fears of a new terror attack after van mows down 20 people on London Bridge," which a Trump tweet followed, and NBC News refused to retweet or even share the information about Drudge or President Trump's tweet, saying, "President Trump has used Twitter to share news reports on London incident. We aren't relaying President's retweet, as the info is unconfirmed." And again, 7 dead, 45 plus injured in this latest attack in the UK, just the second in as many weeks. And we are going through the same, the crazy psychology of, in the UK and in other media outlets, trying to, you know, not justify the attacks, but make excuses for the terrorists. And we're going to get into the terror attacks in this first hour and some of the other information that is related to it or came directly from it. But first, portions of tonight's broadcast are brought to you by ProFlowers.com. That's ProFlowers.com. We are going to have more on that later. Now, back to London. Many of the media outlets online in the UK began to document and create timelines as to what happened. What's really interesting about this is within, I believe it was 8 minutes of the police being called about the bridge incident, is 8 minutes later, the police shot and killed the three Islamic attackers. But back to the original attack, one of the attackers was an ex-KFC London tube worker, and the killer and his two accomplices murdered seven people after mowing down revelers in the central London before going on a rampage wearing fake bomb vests and wielding hunting knives. And there is a number of there's two identifications. There was a number of arrests following these attacks. There was up to 12 arrests within the first 24 hours, and there is quite a bit of footage shot by people who were on the streets, not of the actual attack, but of the aftermath. And there's a few interesting side stories that came out of this. One was the President Donald Trump came under heavy criticism when he referenced the terrorist attack, and then tweeted about the executive order he issued relating to the travel bans, the two executive orders that were shut down by lesser courts over some misconceived idea that they were racist in nature, or that they targeted a specific religion or belief system or actual nationality. And that's neither here nor there, but the president continues to take heat, even though he wants to extend the vetting, and he doubled down on his travel ban claim, saying, you know, we are going to implement this, and people are arguing about the terminology, whether it is a ban. Again, it's a 90-day temporary ban, which allow from seven majority Muslim countries, which allows the intelligence agencies and our other federal agencies time to expand the vetting process. But people are calling it racist, hateful, the same old, same old. One interesting, as we do, we always see how the media, both internationally and here in the U.S., like to use these terrorist opportunities to, one, paint people who blame Islam as crazy conspiracy theorists, racist, Islamophobics. And we always see the media either parading out these talking points, or using it for an excuse to lift up sometimes even the groups who commit these acts. And this time was no different. One of the more interesting stories that came out of this latest terror attack was from CNN. Now, folks, I don't know how many people saw this. I did not post this on the website on HagmanReport.com, but still, it is a very important story. CNN was caught staging a fake protest, I guess you could call it, as in the first 24 hours after the London attack. There is video on a number of sites, and it all stemmed from some bystander who had their phone or a camcorder and recorded what CNN was as they were preparing for a news shot. Subsequently, the news shot was picked up by the AP, by BBC, and a number of other news organizations, which purported to show Muslims holding these signs. And I'm going to find out exactly what the sign says, because now I don't remember. And folks, if you just do a basic search, CNN fake news, this pops up almost immediately. CNN reporter is caught up in fake news row after being accused of setting up Muslim counter-terror protest. And what they were trying to show were Muslim demonstrators against extremism. And video was taken of the group being positioned behind TV crews yesterday by a bystander. And again, CNN was accused on Twitter and several other media outlets as creating a narrative, and this is exactly what this was. And Mark Dice did a great video today, I believe it's only about 3 minutes, where he points this out. But he doesn't just point out the fact that the news, that the narrative was being shaped, that CNN was caught staging a scene with the aftermath of this terror attack. He goes on to point out an example, and I'm going to pull it up here because it's definitely worth the read. he goes on to pull up an example of a journalist, Gene Forman, who wrote a book, The Ethical Journalist. And in this book, he goes on to talk about how most print journalists reject the stage managing of news photographs. That is, directing the people being photographed to do something for the benefit of the camera. These photojournalists argue that a posed photograph cannot ethically be presented as a found moment. A noteworthy example of stage managing occurred in the Los Angeles Times in 1993. While covering a fire scene, a Times reporter, Mike Meadows, suggested that a firefighter go to a swimming pool and pour water over his head to cool off. The result was a stunning photograph, but when the photo director, Larry Armstrong, discovered the circumstances in which it had been taken, he suspended the reporter, saying, "When you manipulate the situation, you manipulate the news." And again, Mark Dice on his YouTube video today on CNN caught stage managing scene in London aftermath goes to lay this out in his video, and that alone is worth the watch. So again, in The Ethical Journalist, it is written, when you manipulate the situation, you manipulate the news. Now, what happened with CNN? There were a group of people with the hashtag Turn to Love and hashtag For London and hashtag ISIS Will Lose. They're holding up these paper signs. There's about 15 people, 15 to 20 people in this photo shoot. And as they're setting up the photo shoot, you see these people each reach down to the ground and they pick up their sign, and they are paraded in front of a camera, and you see men with headphones on, some holding microphones, some in front of computers, urging people to get into the scene. At one point, they'd even pull two white police officers out of the scene and replace them with appears to be two Asian men. And they were called out on this. By not only that, they were caught on video staging this. CNN has since denied the claims that it positioned the anti-extremism demonstration behind the cameras to create a narrative, insisting the group arrived to be seen by TV cameras. But again, CNN, this is all too familiar. We see a major news agency creating a scene, creating something unnatural that's not naturally happening, and parading it around as news. Now, what is accomplished by creating a fake protest of believed to be Muslims speaking out against the latest terror attack? Well, there's a lot there that we need to talk about, because one, CNN has to create this narrative of Muslims protesting a terror attack. Why do they have to create this narrative? Because it is not happening naturally, even by Muslims in a place that has had two devastating terror attacks, in a country that has two devastating terror attacks alone just in the last 2 weeks. Why should that be troubling? Well, can you imagine? And we see it all the time. I guess I shouldn't say, could you imagine? We do. We see it in reality all the time. The constant pandering by the media to terrorists and to Islam, jumping in as soon as a terror attack happens, tearing down anybody who, and calling them Islamophobic, calling them racist, anybody who even identifies the terrorism as Islamic terrorism. Then they have to create these fake protest groups because none seem to happen naturally, at least in the Muslim community. I was listening to a few, media reactions from today, and Michael Savage, he mentioned, when is the last time we've seen a moderate Muslim or moderate Muslims, on TV, calling against this violence, calling against these terror attacks on any of the networks, whether it's CNN or Fox News. And he went to point out that Saudi Arabia, owns 18% of Fox News, or one of the princes of Saudi Arabia owns 18% of Fox News, so don't expect to see it there. But again, the man who filmed this fake protest, who posted it online, he posted it on Twitter first under the hashtag fake news, and the reporter for CNN was Becky Anderson. Now, there are a few more stories online, and I will post one on Hagman Report when I get a chance, probably after the show, but the video was shared more than 14,000 times on social media network and liked more than 16,000 times. The man who filmed the footage, he claimed that the white police officers left the protest scene around the time the news crews came and put minority officers in a more visible position. In other words, he claimed that the footage was being staged. On top of that, he's the one who filmed it. And there was a large outcry on social media. Sites like the Gateway Pundit and others called CNN out for this. And CNN denied that they, even though that it's on tape, even though that you can hear and see the people directing these people to pick up the signs, to stand behind the police line, to get move one way or another, to be able to fit into the shot, CNN continues to deny that this was created by them. And not only that, again, I said, many other news agencies picked this up. You had the BBC. You had, I believe, Sky News picked it up. The AP ran it as one of their, you know, top pictures of coming together in the face of tragedy. And by today, by the time I checked, only one or two of the sites had that actual picture up there. They had the same articles, and they described the same things as in this, you know, fake protest, but they actually removed the picture that was staged by the CNN news footage out of their picture of what the article originally talked about. Now, there's a lot of excuses being tossed around as to why this attack happened. Who were these people? Where were they from? Were they national? Were they immigrants? And more information is coming out from there. Again, there was a delay on the names that were released due to the continuing investigation being done by the police there, as there was at least 10 or 12 more arrests that took place in the last 24 hours since this attack has happened Saturday night. So will we see more arrests? Have any of the arrests led to more actionable intel? If you remember, after the Manchester attack, we saw a number of arrests take place, and then we saw the threat level raised to critical, where the army was actually pushed out on the street. We're not seeing that same kind of government reaction this time, but what's interesting is that we now see that they are reporting this was not just, you know, a group of Islamists who decided to do something. This was part of a terrorist cell, a sleeper cell, and that they do believe that they were working with other terrorist networks in carrying out this attack. Now, there's a lot more information coming out about the attackers, which it seems all too common with this type of attack, that these people were known to the government. These people were being monitored. These people were being surveilled by the authorities in the UK. And there is a whole host of red flags, from this guy having some kind of farewell barbecue to the day before or the week before, to a number of things that you know, make you ask why, if these people were being surveilled, why were these red flags glossed over? Why were they ignored? Could the surveillance and intelligence communities of the UK been able to stop these people? Especially since, again, they knew who they were. These people were under surveillance. They were on watch list, and they were actually being watched by the government. And so there's a lot here. You know, they describe the one guy as the ex-KFC worker. And one interesting thing, they say the ringleader, and I don't know the name of the ringleader. They say that this was a very nice man. He bought ice cream for the kids. He helped older people shop in their neighborhood, and what was very friendly. Never were there signs to the neighbors that this guy was a dangerous terrorist. So I believe we're going to learn more about exactly who these people were, and what will we see in terms of a response. We're already seeing Theresa May talk about some questionable things, and InfoWars had a good piece on this, which I will pull up. But Theresa May took a kind of an odd step. Well, I guess not an odd step. Many people are saying that this Theresa May's response was very dangerous. I guess it's surprising, not odd. Surprising. Excuse me. Okay. Theresa May came out, and this is what the Independent reported. The dishonest and dangerous response of Theresa May's UK government to the horrific terrorist attack of the past month is unfortunately all too common when it comes to those in power. Now, what did she do that was so surprising? She called for the UK and government policies in the UK and its leaders to push through an authoritarian expansion of state power, specifically by censoring the internet. Theresa May's government is using the attacks to push for regulation and censorship of the internet. As reported by the Independent, new international agreements should be introduced to regulate the internet in light of the London Bridge terror attack, Theresa May has said. The Prime Minister said introducing new rules for cyberspace would deprive the extremists of their safe spaces online, and that technology firms were not currently doing enough. We cannot allow this ideology the safe spaces it needed to breed, yet that is precisely what the internet and the big companies that provide internet-based services provide, she says. And she goes on to cite the Conservative Manifesto, which states the Conservative Manifesto pledges regulation of the internet, including forcing internet providers to participate in counter-extremism drives and making it more difficult to access pornography. Now, I could go on to read her statement, but I'm not going to do that because we all know that this is a big joke, if you will, calling for the internet to be regulated because of the continued terrorism that is happening in her country is something that does not compute for a lot of people. And InfoWars pointed out, and I'll pull up the article from my history because I can't find it on their front page. They pointed out that just a few weeks ago, I believe it was May 19th, that isn't it interesting that Theresa May, again, or I guess the first time, was calling for tougher internet regulations. This article, Kit Daniels from InfoWars, posted today, June 5th. Flashback. British PM pushed internet regulations before London attack. Perfect example of problem, reaction, solution. And I'll just read the first paragraph. Kit Daniels wrote this. I'm reposting this InfoWars article from May 19th to document how British Prime Minister Theresa May wanted strict internet regulations, including curbs on free speech, weeks before the London attack this past weekend. This is a prime example of how the government fuels a problem, Islamic terrorism, then offers a predetermined solution to the problem, which only expands government power at the expense of individual rights without solving the actual problem. And that's very well said, and the article goes on to talk about how Theresa May wants the UK to pioneer online speech regulations that would effectively create a new government-controlled internet. Now, in the UK, we know they already have hate speech laws for the general public. You cannot say something nasty to another person. You cannot, call them a terrorist. You could get arrested for calling an actual Islamic terrorist a terrorist. So the free speech laws are already in place. And how would these internet regulations actually affect stopping terrorism or the ability for these people to communicate? I don't believe it would for a second, and I know many of our audience don't believe that for a second. They're using this as an excuse to gain more control over the internet, which, you know, I guess could be the last frontier or still the Wild West of free thought and ideas. And we see companies, Facebook, Twitter, Google, that don't censor the terroristic content. They censor those critical to terrorists, or if those people who might hurt the terrorist feelings, we see that they will ban those accounts, shadow ban those accounts, censor those tweets or posts, 24-hour suspension, 12-hour suspension, whatever it is. We remember with the Manchester attack, we saw that 4 to 6 hours before it happened, an ISIS affiliate used Twitter to actually post about the upcoming attack, the impending attack, and the actual location of the attack. And I don't have that tweet right in front of me, but it definitely talked about a terror attack. This is for Islam, and he went on to say Manchester Arena. Now, what's interesting about this latest London Bridge attack that is being barely reported, it's not being reported by many news outlets, is that the terrorists, after they ran over the people on the bridge, when they got out, before they started stabbing people, said, "This is for Allah. This is for Islam." And for some reason, that fact and other important facts are being kept, you know, mainly in the dark, censored from the public eye. And that is very concerning, yet it, at the same time, it is par for the course with these people. We are coming up against the break. We have a great show for you tonight with the guests that we have on. In the third hour, we have Sheila Zielinski coming on. Her website is Weekend Vigilante. She wrote the book The Green Gospel. And she's going to be coming on to talk about the Paris Climate Accord in the third hour. And how many of you guys remember Loretta Fuddy? Well, Hugo Fuegan is going to be coming on in this next segment, and we're going to get an update from him into the Loretta Fuddy investigation, as well as other updates that he has found as he's been a previous guest on our show. So we got a lot of stuff to get into, folks. We'll be right back after these short messages. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. Stay tuned.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back. In a thrilling series of novels, T.C. Joseph takes us into the lives of three families who struggle to maintain normal lives in a world where conspiracy theory and Bible prophecy collide. T.C. Joseph's viewpoint of alternative history and understanding of prophetic events will change your view of the world and the events on our horizon. Kirkus Review states, readers of end times fiction will be hard-pressed to find it done more intriguingly than this. Extremely readable and fast-paced. Blue Wink Reviews boldly states, fans of Tim LaHaye's Left Behind series and Tom Perata's The Leftovers will find this thought-provoking series absolutely riveting. Order your copies of T.C. Joseph's This Generation series from Amazon.com. Book 1, Precipice. Book 2, Pentecost. And Book 3, Penance.
In these uncertain times, it makes sense to have a sustainable backup method to cook food and boil water. If your current plan includes using a fuel-burning stove or cooking over an open fire, then there's a much better way. The Minuteman Rocket Stove is a biomass-burning cooking stove that only requires small quantities of sticks and twigs for fuel. The Minuteman Stove is easy to use, smokeless, portable, powerful, and sustainable. For the finest in survival cooking stoves and fire starters made right here in the USA, go to MinutemanStove.com. That's MinutemanStove.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. A world dismissed as conspiracy by those who want to keep its secrets hidden. Exposing the dangers, denials, and deceptions. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.
Thank you.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We are going to get into the Loretta Fuddy, update on the Loretta Fuddy investigation, and a lot of updated information, both visual and audio, with Hugo Fuegen right after this message.
Dad's out there. Let me ask you a question. Do you love steak like I do? Of course you do. You know, I remember last Father's Day, I got a package from Omaha Steaks, and it was fantastic. We grilled up some fantastic steaks, and what a taste, and what a great, how exciting it is to get a package of Omaha Steaks. And I'd recommend anyone listening out there who's got a dad, who's got that special guy in your life, get him the gift of Omaha Steaks. Well, I'll tell you, if you're looking for a Father's Day gift, the perfect Father's Day gift, may I add, we have the perfect Father's Day gift for you. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how to get this Father's Day. For this Father's Day, for only $49.99, you can get our limited time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com, enter HH in the search bar to apply the savings. That's omahasteaks.com, enter HH in the search bar to apply the savings. You might ask yourself, why Omaha Steaks? Why not just go to the grocery store? Well, Omaha Steaks has got the highest quality beef. It's got a one-of-a-kind flavor. It's convenient. All the beef is USDA inspected for quality and exceeds standards. Aged 21 days to unlock the full flavors of the cuts. It's hand-trimmed, vacuum-sealed. It's so convenient to get. Online support with recipes, wine pairings, and so much more. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving you, our listeners, a limited-time offer for Father's Day. This is a really amazing deal. You'll get 80%. That's right, 80% off Omaha Steaks Father's Day package, which includes, now listen to this, two tender mild beef filet mignons. Oh, yeah. Two bold beefy tipped sirloins. Those are great. Everything's great, by the way. Four crispy chicken fried steaks. Four juicy boneless pork chops. Four all beef Omaha steak burgers. Four award winning gourmet jumbo franks. 12 ounces of all beef meatballs. Oh, are they, those meatballs alone are just fabulous. 1 pound of steakhouse fries. Four made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets. You're going to want more. One Omaha Steaks seasoning packet plus four additional burgers free. That's right. All that for $49.99, under $50. You can't beat the price, especially this Father's Day. Again, this is a, you get this limited-time package for only $49.99. When you go to omahasteaks.com, type HH in the search bar and add Father's Day package to your cart. One more time, you go to omahasteaks.com, type in HH in the search bar, and add Father's Day package to your cart. Don't wait. This offer will end soon. Go to omahasteaks.com, type HH in the search bar, grab your dad, and fire up that grill.
Joining us now is Hugo Fuegen. He is an aviation expert as well as an author, and the book that he authored is The Fuddy Hoax. And we have Hugo with us, and we're going to get into, he's a returning guest, we're going to get into some of the important information that we have covered in previous shows, as well as some of the updated new information that Hugo has uncovered. Hugo, welcome back to the Hagman and Hagman Report.
Thank you. It's very nice to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. It's been a while since we've had you on, and a lot of people might ask, who is Loretta Fuddy? If we can, let's start there. If you can give us a little bit of background into the investigation, the very detailed investigation that you've laid out in your book, The Fuddy Hoax.
Well, Loretta Fuddy was a Hawaiian Department of Health official, and she was appointed by Neil Abercrombie, specifically, it would appear, for this time period where former President Obama, needed to get out his real long-form birth certificate. He was prompted somewhat in that by Donald Trump, who was trying to get that done. And she was able to produce a document, but that was notably seen by many experts as fraudulent. And it has been investigated by people like Sheriff Arpaio and his cold case posse in Arizona. And they have determined as well through expert examination that that was fraudulent. So Loretta Fuddy was in the hot seat for explaining how that might be fraudulent. And there were court cases ongoing that might well have brought her onto the witness stand for explaining how that might have happened. So rather than see that happen, I believe it was important that she disappear from the real-world scenario and be disappeared, if you will, as a valuable asset to the ongoing narrative of the Obama presidency.
Yes, and folks who remember who Loretta Fuddy was and, you know, her role in Hawaii and the birth certificate and the whole Obama-Trump fiasco, I believe it's still very relevant today. And Hugo, let me ask you your opinion on this. With Donald Trump in the White House now, are you surprised that we have not seen any release of Obama's records? Is that something that is out of Donald Trump's hands? And do you expect him to show anything along these lines?
Well, I believe that there probably will be disclosure of Obama's records. Over time, the interest to see those outweighs the ability to keep it hidden, probably. But that's speculation, and I'd prefer not to do very much of that. I think that we will hear about Obama's background, and certainly we can know a number of things that haven't been disclosed thus far. That is, there are people more willing to speak now, as perhaps I am as well. That is, without Obama wielding the control of the presidency, I, as well as others, are more willing to come forward and explain some of the background to some of these activities, which, if I had done while he was still president, would have been very more difficult.
Yes, and again, your book, The Fuddy Hoax, is a very, very detailed account. And folks, again, Hugo is an aviation expert. So not only do we have, you know, the political side of this with everything that we saw that came out in the media from Donald Trump's questions to, you know, the birth certificate, but there is so much of this investigation that you will never see reported on the mainstream or even on most alternative media. Some either think it's non-important or a non-issue, or that there's nothing we can do about it. But, you know, it brings to mind that the Seth Rich investigation that many of us have been so heavily investigating, trying to understand what really happened, especially when we see, you know, the reports it was a failed robbery. Then we learn that he very well could have been the DNC WikiLeaks leaker. And then, you know, his untimely death, the police reluctancy to either stand down or, you know, whatever was going on there, and just all the outcry we have. You know, this is a very similar situation, just different circumstances with Loretta Fuddy, because Loretta Fuddy wasn't a leaker. She wasn't going against the administration or the administration's narrative, but she was in a position, as you say, Hugo, was in a position potentially to not change her story, but to, you know, tell the truth or to tell what was really going on. And conveniently, as happens so often in these cases, especially when things are going to court or could be coming out in the open, these people conveniently pass away. And this seems like another example of a potential political hit being done to keep something covered up.
So, a lot of people have thought of this as a possible murder. And although I have a lot of evidence that suggests that wasn't the case, they would think that it might be appropriate to get rid of that fuddy voice in that fashion. Well, I believe that she was a valuable asset who had done her good work for the political partisans that she was favoring in a way that I think would redound positively to them if she was taken care of rather than silenced with a murder. That is, there would be a lot of people cringing in closets rather than helping the previous administration if they treat their very valuable people this way. But as I say, I'm quite sure by the evidence that the Loretta Fuddy, as a high value target, if you will, was extracted from the scenario that we know about and in which many people think she was murdered, but I'm sure she wasn't.
Yeah, and you know, this is what's really interesting about this case specifically is even let's just dismiss all the surrounding political stuff from this. You have one, this happened, this was a plane crash where there was an NTSB investigation done. Two, there was an actual video made from the plane of the plane crash. Everybody survived except Loretta Fuddy, and there's basically a video of her in the water alive after this happened. So there's a lot of evidence here. There's a lot of there's government reports with the NTSB, the plane crash. It was a very public thing that happened. So if you can, Hugo, let's go through this a little bit. Loretta Fuddy was on a plane. It went down.
There is an official narrative, of course, and there are those things that we were told. But the things we were told and what really happened are at great variance with one another. And fortunately, even though I believe the people that planned this event were in favor of making that video and seeing it displayed prominently throughout the world, I think it has done them more harm than good, because it unfavorable to their cause discloses many, many, many facts that ultimately helped break this case. It wasn't the only thing, of course, though I believe they wanted to squelch the birtherism, as they call it, the people who had concerns about the documentation of this president and whether it was able to show him as being eligible for the presidency. So a lot of people have mischaracterized that about so-called birthers. But that narrative, I think, is a very honorable one. It doesn't claim things that were not true. It simply asks the question of when are we going to see legitimate documentation that is not ultimately shown as fraudulent. But we can start with the official narrative.
Okay.
And maybe your tech person can go to slide 2, which shows kind of a map overview. And it shows there the Hawaiian Islands where this crash took place. And there in the left middle is the island of Molokai, where there's a peninsula on the northern side. It's a five square mile peninsula. And at the northwest edge of that peninsula is a runway called Kalaupapa Airport, which is near the small settlement that has been over the past 150 or so years a leper colony that has been administered by the Hawaii Department of Health. And that'll be in the lower right portion of the screen. You can see a few of the buildings that are in that settlement. But the runway is on the northwest edge. And you can see there a red track departing runway 5 at that airport. And there's a red X in the middle of that track, and it shows where there was claimed to be a catastrophic engine failure of a Cessna Grand Caravan, which was flying with 8 paying passengers and a pilot, a very high-time pilot, very experienced, it would seem. But so that plane had that failure, or claimed failure, at that red X or thereabouts, and then put the airplane in the water at the capital D that one can see at the top of that map on the right side. So that was what happened. That is, we know that it landed at that particular place, but the person or the airplane that came upon the event within minutes of its ditching into the water actually reported to the Honolulu Control Facility of the FAA and the U.S. Coast Guard in turn that the aircraft actually was at where that yellow pushpin is on that map. And that was, there were also lat lawn coordinates given. And so the confirmation of that being a half a mile offshore, and that coordinate, which is indeed a half mile offshore, tells us that, the pilot of that, first aircraft that came upon the scene was not exactly telling the truth. Elsewhere, the FAA has them recorded as initially reporting 300 yards offshore, and that's indeed much more accurate, and coincidentally, we'll learn that it may be quite relevant that the location of that, if it should have been within a quarter mile of shore, was to be treated very different by the authorities. That is, Maui County would deal with that kind of an incident very differently if it were outside the quarter-mile boundary of where it occurred. So it actually did occur well within the quarter-mile boundary, but it was reported by several people, and among them that first on-the-scene aircraft, as having been a half mile or even more outside away from shore. Now, there were pictures that showed what seemed to be an aircraft. I guess we'll come to that shortly, so I won't jump ahead, but basically there's a lot of question in terms of what the official narrative was about where the actual aircraft put down. But we do have very accurate measurements, and we know, in fact, that it was very close to 234 yards from shore. We've measured that in a number of different ways, and it's been confirmed in several others, so we know where that aircraft landed. So if we hear what the pilot has to say about that, in addition to claim of a catastrophic engine failure, which lost all power for the aircraft, and the engine stopped, he said, those parts of the narrative turn out not to be true. And even though he claims that the engine stopped, we'll find that we hear in the background of the video a very nicely running, smoothly running engine. And that's a problem for this scenario, because people have made various claims about everything having gone quiet. That is, pilots testified to the police and said everything went quiet. But that is in conflict with what we hear on and see on the video. So there are problems like that, and the narrative as it's shown both in the media and in the NTSB report is shown to be false. And we don't have to make an interpretation about that. It simply is contradicted by solid evidence that is very hard to controvert. Now, I mentioned the passengers saying everything went quiet, which in fact is a uniquely consistent representation, literally verbatim, between several passengers. And one might say, how is that possible? I mean, there are counterclaims. The pilot says as well that there were all kinds of bells and whistles going off, and yet it was quiet. So that's a contradictory statement that the videographer made in the media, which just doesn't seem to bear, can't be possible. And similarly, the video that we have actually has 6 seconds of quiet time, and then after those 6 seconds, the engine magically starts up again. And that, too, is a physical impossibility that shows the official narrative cannot be the case. But we should move on, and let me ask the tech if he could move on to slide 3.
Okay.
And there we see that even though the pilot represented the airplane to have had this so-called catastrophic engine failure at 300 feet, we see in the video of the takeoff that the airplane climbs literally on the runway heading for about 500 feet, which is a very standard takeoff profile. And then it begins turning for another 28 seconds, ultimately achieving the same place that the pilot said in terms of over the ground, but it was not at 300 feet as he claimed, but it was in fact closer to about 1,000 feet or maybe even as high as 1,500, which in fact was two numbers that were on the lips in the media of two of the passengers. They said the aircraft descended from about 1,000 to 1,500 feet, both using that exact same term. So again, the data is very much in conflict. The evidence is in conflict, and I think we can side with the video, which cannot be converted just because someone says something different. But the pilot tried to say it was at 300 feet that this happened, and he actually wrote to the NTSB saying it was about 500 feet that it happened. But we know that the plane was already at 500 feet when he turned away from the runway, and he climbed for another 28 seconds. So it's just not reasonable, though one can imagine why one might want to say it was at 300 feet where this catastrophic engine failure happened, because then it would give an excuse to not be able to get back to the runway and make a safe landing. But that just was filled with misrepresentation. If we can look at the slide 4, we see the last frame of the videographer's takeoff video. Now, the video was in two different parts, a takeoff portion, then it supposedly stopped, and then it starts up with what they call, or what I've called at least, the ditching section. That is, the videographer started up the video after this claimed catastrophic engine failure, which coincidentally, of course, misses being recorded on the video, under that so-called official narrative at least. And then it descends down into the water. And we can see on the right portion that the satellite map shows various lines, but it does show the lines of the sun's rays, and what we see on the left side is indeed the videographer portion of his face, and we see those sun's rays going pretty much athwart or 90 degrees from the direction of travel of the aircraft at that time, which indeed would have been as the aircraft is turning toward Honolulu, rounding the turn, as the pilot said, and Honolulu is directly west of the airport. But if that happened that way, the idea would have to be that with no power, the pilot would have gone from that red X to where we know the aircraft ditched, and that capital D. But in doing that kind of a maneuver, he would say from 300 feet, but we would have quite a bit of evidence that shows it's from 1,000 or more feet. Anyway, taking that heading, which is roughly a downwind for runway 5, had about 15 knots of tailwind for the pilot, in as much as the wind was coming out of the east at 18 knots. So making that track between the red X and the capital D puts an extra 15 knots of tailwind, and if the pilot had conversely gone into the wind with his touchdown onto the water, he would have been at 30 knots less ground speed, and made a safer touchdown in that fashion.
Right.
But the claim,
and that's
claim as
the,
it was.
The when you're flying, and what you're saying is, if you were flying into the wind, that it would have gave the aircraft greater resistance.
Yes, it would have gone the airplane, say with the true airspeed of 80 knots, it would have gone 35 knots over the ground, because it would have had that kind of a headwind, kind of a river of air coming at the pilot. But if one has 15 knots of tailwind and you're flying 80 knots, you're now flying 95 knots over the ground. And if you're touching down on the water at 95 knots versus 35 knots, did I say that right? Versus 65 knots, frankly. So there's like a 30 knot difference, and no pilot, especially one who is very well trained, would ever make that choice. And we know this pilot was exquisitely trained, having 16,000 hours or more of flight experience. So he would not have made that choice. And in fact, we know he didn't make that choice, even though, given the official narrative, we're left to believe he must have taken that track between the red X and the capital D. We in fact know what the track was of that airplane, and it was that orange arc one sees to the left. And the aircraft was able to be put directly into the wind just as it touched down, which is, of course, a reasonable and good piloting technique, but the problem is it doesn't match the narrative.
Yeah.
Let's move on to
and
number
Hugo,
five.
Just, yes, to, just to let you know, we have a break coming up in about 45 seconds.
Okay.
So maybe we should stop here before we go to the break. Can you tell folks where they can order your book?
Well, the website is just now being worked on for that, and it'll be called thefuddyhoax.com. If they'd care to send an email to info@thefuddyhoax.com, we'll make sure that they are notified as soon as the book is available and the website is available for their use. So if they send email, preferably with their name and address, email address will, of course, be implicit, their return email address, but we'll make sure that they have the first opportunity to order the book.
Fantastic. Folks, we are up against the break. We are talking with Hugo Fuegen. The book is The Fuddy Hoax. And again, if you want the book, info@thefuddyhoax.com. Send your contact info, and when the website's up, they will get the book out to you. We'll be right back after these short messages. Don't go anywhere.
Greenovative. Go to HagmanReport.com. Click on the link to Greenovative. But what Greenovative is, it's a small company in Florida. They created something called the G-Mag Power Cell. It produces electricity by adding salt water to this unit that recharges rechargeable batteries. It's the coolest thing you'll ever see in your life. It's really neat. Really a super device. All right? You need just 2 teaspoons of ordinary table salt, a little water, but a bang, you're charging your rechargeable batteries. Super G-Mag Chargeable is affordable, it's lightweight, weighs about 8 ounces, it's durable, it's EMP proof, and it's environmentally friendly, yeah, that it is. It'll provide safe and convenient power for recharging 6 AA batteries off the grid when other power sources aren't available anywhere, anytime, in any weather, day or night. Go to greenovative.com. That's greenovative.com. Folks, in these uncertain times, it just makes sense to have a sustainable backup method for accomplishing one of life's most important tasks, and that's preparing food. This is the way to go. There is nothing better than a Minuteman rocket stove from MinutemanStove.com. We all need a way to cook and a method to process water. I mean, think about it. Think about the many things that could happen to you. Minuteman rocket stove can provide your family or group the perfect solution. It's small, lightweight, wood-burning, and every bit as powerful as a kitchen stove. It's small, smokeless, fully self-contained for clean storage and transport. Because it's so efficient, it cuts down on your wood gathering and processing chores to a tenth what would be required if cooking the old-fashioned way over an open fire. So don't rely on gas or fuel stoves. Prepare your family. Prepare for yourself. Order a Minuteman rocket stove today. It's going to make bad times much better. Folks, MinutemanStove.com. MinutemanStove.com. Need I say more?
You should have a Minuteman, the survival stove in an ammo can.
For investors, timberland has become the symbol of safety. Global tropical timber demand continues to surge as the world's population increases. The need for managed, sustainable timber production forests has never been greater. When stock markets crash, trees keep growing. Direct ownership of fully managed tropical timberland acreage is now available to accredited investors. Prime, valuable hardwood groves close to the beautiful Costa Rican border generate and maintain superior long-term wealth. Consider visiting our forest plantations. Qualified accredited investors should go to PreciousTimberProfits.com or dial 855-888-6288 for more information. Call 855-888-6288 or visit PreciousTimberProfits.com. This announcement does not constitute either an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offering made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288, PreciousTimberProfits.com, PreciousTimberProfits.com.